You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a collected work by Rudolf Steiner, number 181. The main title is Dying Earth and Living Cosmos. It's actually composed of 21 lectures in three smaller cycles. I am on the fifth lecture of the last cycle, which is entitled The Need for New Forms of Consciousness. And this fifth lecture in that smaller cycle is numbered in this book, Lecture 20, given in Berlin on the 30th of July, 1918, translated by Matthew Barton. Today I will continue by outlining a few further things relating to our recent reflections. Understanding the present day, with all its divergent currents of spiritual and materialistic views, is extremely difficult, and one ought not to think that this confused picture of modern times can be understood without having the will to perceive how these times have long been in preparation as history slowly unfolded. Today, drawing on our spiritual scientific insights, we will look back to what we call the fourth post-Atlantean epoch. As you know, this epoch began around the year 747 BC and ended as the 15th century began, in around 1413. The dates themselves must, of course, be regarded, like all such figures, as an approximation. In this period, we find at work certain powers that have an inner consistency and mutual relationship, and differ essentially from all the powers prevailing both before and after this epoch. This time, during which the rational or mind-soul developed in human nature, can be further subdivided into three smaller eras. The period starting around 747 BC, the date, in fact, when Rome was actually founded, and ended about 27 BC. The second period extends from this date, 27 BC, to roughly the end of the 7th century AD, that is, to the year 693. And the last and shorter period lasts from 693 to around 1413. Since that time, around 1413, we have been in a new phase of soul development, with distinctive qualities with which we are already familiar. We can make a clear distinction in terms of human soul evolution between the fourth post-Atlantean epoch and the three preceding epochs of ancient India, ancient Persia, and Egypt Chaldea, and likewise between this fourth epoch and the fifth that follows it. In the same way, we can also clearly distinguish characteristic stages within this fourth epoch itself, which are significant for the development of civilization. In each of these shorter phases, we can observe how humanity progresses in particular ways. Taking the first of these phases, 747 to 27 BC, footnote, Steiner actually says 27 years before the mystery of Golgotha, and it is therefore not clear if he means 27 BC or 6 AD. End of footnote. We will naturally think first and foremost of the peoples living around the Mediterranean, in whom we find developing a very particular state of soul. History tells us little about this except, since its ideas and concepts avoid engaging with really characteristic qualities. If we wish to properly characterize this period and the inner factors of humanity's evolution at work then, we can say that during it, human souls slowly detach themselves from a connection with the whole spiritual cosmos. If we look back to Egyptian and Chaldean times, the epoch of the sentient soul, human beings felt that their soul belonged to the cosmos. The sentient soul in human nature sensed that the human being is a part of the universe. We cannot properly describe Egyptian and Chaldean evolution without taking account of the fact that people in those times, in observing the cosmos around them, received through their senses and feelings something that came to expression in this awareness of harmony with the spiritual cosmos, of being part of it. Just as we can say that the fingers of our hands are and feel one with us, so people in ancient Egypt and Chaldea felt themselves one with the spiritual cosmos. This feeling for the cosmos underwent a crisis in the 8th century BC, was shaken to its roots. In the past, human souls owed their sense of belonging with the cosmos to their ancient, atavistic, and dreamy clairvoyance. In those days, people did not perceive as we do today. In their sense perceptions, they also perceived the spirit, the divine, a faculty which modern scholars, in their ignorance, call animism. In this way, people of those times felt intimately connected with the spirit of the cosmos. This intimate connection faded, and on the one hand, this led to many symptoms of decadence, while on the other, it led to the wonders of Greek culture. You see, the culture of ancient Greece is founded primarily on the human being's experience of standing in isolation in the universe, no longer as an intrinsic part of the cosmos, but as a complete and self-encompassing human totality. In a sense, the human being had emerged from the cosmos and embarked on an existence that was complete in itself. The beauties and wonders of Greek culture could never have emerged if a more ancient form of soul experience had continued to prevail, such as held sway in ancient India, for instance, along with this sense of close belonging to the cosmos. The glories of Greek culture, which in other regions also surfaced as less delightful phenomena, all developed between the 8th and 1st centuries BC. Humanity withdrew into the realm of soul, into the purely human, approaching the mystery of Golgotha as this period progressed. Let us not forget that the mystery of Golgotha inevitably has a quality that cannot entirely be encompassed by human understanding, nor human supersensible understanding either. Some part of it inevitably evades our comprehension. What was accomplished as Christ entered earthly evolution cannot, as I have explained in various previous reflections, be summed up in human concepts or encompassed in human feelings. And connected with this is the fact that as this mystery of Golgotha developed, in a sense, civilized humanity was prepared for it in a way that did not allow full awareness or experience of this event to dawn. Instead, it occurred alongside and at one remove from ordinary human experience. In terms of history, this is fairly clear. Civilized humanity around the Mediterranean took little notice of Christ Jesus, nor of what was happening in the far-flung Jewish province of Palestine. This scarcely figures even in Tacitus, writing 100 years after the mystery of Golgotha. On the one hand, therefore, we have advancing civilization, and on the other, at one remove from it, a current in which the mystery of Golgotha occurred. These two streams flow alongside but separate from each other. This could only happen because as the divine act was accomplished, civilization had shut itself off from the divine, and a life was unfolding which no longer had a direct connection with the spirit. A spiritual event took place upon the globe which human civilization itself ignored. In all former times, it would have been inconceivable for such a division to exist between outward culture and a mystery event, since human culture in those days was fully informed by an awareness of divine spiritual realities. It is very characteristic, highly significant, that the mundane culture running parallel to the mystery of Golgotha had closed itself off and therefore was distanced from this event. In the second period of this epoch, thus beginning around 27 BC and ending in AD 693, the whole of Central European culture is basically founded on preventing any understanding of the mystery of Golgotha from informing mundane civilization. It may seem very strange to you that I say this, since Christianity did indeed spread abroad through the Central European culture of those times, and yet it spread in the way I recently described. The mystery of Golgotha occurred in splendid isolation. Certainly, aspects of it reached mainstream culture in an external and dogmatic fashion. People knew that Christ had come, that he had disciples, brought this or that to humanity, and made this or that remark about the human being's relationship to the divine. This entered mundane culture in the form of outward phrases and principles. And yet alongside these externalities, it was also true that the whole of humanity, really, which absorbed Christianity during these centuries, remained distant from any inner understanding of the mystery of Golgotha. It would have been possible to gain deeper insight into what actually happened at the mystery of Golgotha with the aid of gnosis and certain forms of preparation founded on traditional wisdom passed down from heathen peoples. But this did not happen. Such things were all declared heretical. Instead, trivial formulations were used as a narrow mold into which to pour Christianity, whose deeper aspects, of course, can never be limited and confined in this way. The mystery of Golgotha can be comprehended only through the highest spiritual striving and the fruits of wisdom this can reveal. The institutions established in the early Christian centuries really did not serve to connect people with the mystery of Golgotha, but instead inculcated something in people's souls that remained very distant from any sense of communion with it. Rather than fostering insight, the Church cultivated non-understanding of the mystery of Golgotha. If you trace the history of the various ecumenical councils and all the ecclesiastical machinations during this period, you will find that all this aimed to inculcate dogmatic ideas in people of a kind that sought to ensure that everything connected with the mystery of Golgotha would be conceived in terms far removed from the life of the human soul. We can sum all this up, albeit somewhat radically, by saying that people tried to equip themselves with certain ideas about the mystery of Golgotha and its effects. And yet what they might find out about this was not the most important thing. Instead, they were intent on cultivating the sense that the mystery of Golgotha did not directly concern them, and that Christ would ensure they were saved. There was a tendency increasingly to push the reality of these sacred spiritual events into another realm altogether, rather than conceiving of them as being connected with what unfolds in the human breast. These two things were to be kept as far as possible sundered. An unconscious aim was at work here, a self-evident and yet not articulated intention. And this only surfaced clearly in the year 869 at the 8th Ecumenical Council in Constantinople. This goal was to prevent the human spirit from any direct personal preoccupation with spiritual reality, which instead was to be confined to the mystery of Golgotha. In other words, efforts were afoot to quash any personal feeling engagement with the mystery of Golgotha. It was to remain shrouded in incomprehension. By this means, the Church sought gradually to subject people to its authority, allowing them only a mundane understanding of these mysteries, and increasingly cultivating the belief that one cannot reflect upon supersensible things, since they are beyond the scope of an individual human soul. Human reflection was to limit itself to physical reality only, rather than developing powers suitable for seeking an understanding of the mystery of Golgotha. In certain resolutions passed by the Eighth Ecumenical Council at Constantinople, we find a clear articulation of efforts to prevent people in Europe from thinking for themselves, since human soul faculties were not to engage with the realm of living reality to which the mystery of Golgotha belongs. Precisely in this middle period of the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, therefore, from around 27 BC to AD 693, a belief was cultivated in humanity that all human knowledge and feeling was fit only for this sensory realm of existence, the non-sensory or supersensible realm, the other side of existence, or whatever one wishes to call it, was withdrawn from direct knowledge and perception, put beyond the scope of human feeling and faculties. Really, we can only understand the history of this whole period if we consider this. Throughout these centuries, all the actions of the Catholic Church aimed to inculcate in people the belief that their soul faculties were fit only for the physical realm, and the supersensible realm could approach them only without the involvement of their own powers of understanding and perception. Because of this, after the end of this middle period, thus around the 8th and 9th century, European humanity was plunged into a kind of darkness as far as the human soul's connection with the supersensible realm was concerned. Bernard of Clairvaux is typical of a phenomenon that can be understood in this context, as someone standing beyond everything physical and sensory and devoting his soul entirely to all that exceeds the scope of natural human understanding. This fervor for what lies beyond human comprehension must be included in our view of someone like Bernard, with his whole configuration of soul. In this figure particularly, we can find traits of mighty grandeur, since everything that is somewhat shifted or distorted can also have a beautiful, grand, and glorious aspect. But in Bernard, too, we will find characteristics of soul which show clearly that he emerged from the prevailing mood developing in Western culture in these centuries. Besides Bernard of Clairvaux, one might name other figures. He is merely typical of them, for instance, in the way he speaks to his followers, of all that will be vouchsafed to them by the crusade he intends to embark on. Then the crusade fails, but how does this fervently devout man speak about the failure? Roughly as follows. If everything ends badly, the verdict on this failure may be meted out to me, but not to God, for the divine can never be wrong. So even when a person knew himself to be closely connected with the divine spiritual power underlying all reality, he makes a careful distinction between this reality and himself, saying that he will bear the blame, but that truth and spiritual reality exist beyond such fault, beyond the current of existence on which the human soul is born. At the beginning of the third era of the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, therefore, a kind of darkness had come to shroud humanity. We can see this in the fact that human concepts no longer testify to a connection with real spiritual streams and impulses. If you study philosophy, written in the centuries from the 8th to the 15th, you will find that it continually seeks to prove that spiritual reality cannot be grasped by human ideas and concepts. It was thought that this reality must be, quote, left to revelation, close quote, in the phrase of the time, and to ecclesiastical teachings. Thus the power of the Church developed, emerging not only from theological impulses, but from this doctrine that people must limit their own powers of cognition, their own faculties of soul, to physical and sensory life, and refrain from trying to fathom the supersensible realm with their thinking. The concept of faith arose from this at a later date, and was certainly not present in the early centuries, as you can conclude from historical documents. This idea of faith states that faith rather than knowledge is the only possible human response to the divine. This division between the truth available to faith and that available to knowledge developed from these important historical contexts which underlie what I have been speaking of today. Since the 15th century, roughly since the year 1413, we live, as the third millennium will show, in a period founded on everything that happened under influences such as those I have described. We carry this legacy with us. And yet at the same time, an entirely new quality is also developing in this fifth post-Atlantean epoch. In that fourth epoch, if we survey its whole compass, we see the human soul being sundered from the divine spiritual world, being directed to and becoming dependent upon merely external physical and sensory processes. This was a new development at that time, and did not exist, as I have said, in ancient Egyptian and Chaldean epochs. In our age, something new is likewise entering, and humanity's task is increasingly to become more conscious so as to recognize all this, seeing, on the one hand, what has been passed down as legacy from a past epoch, and what, on the other, is emerging as a new development in our own epoch. Let us first consider the legacy passed down to us. As we saw, we have inherited a frame of mind in which we feel convinced that we must develop our soul life quite separately from the supersensible realm. The further legacy of this, as you will see the more carefully you study history, is a clear conviction in which no room for doubt remains that rooting human soul faculties in the sensory domain and shutting them off from the supersensible led to a situation in the fifth post-Atlantean epoch. Thus, since the 15th century, in which this whole supersensible realm was dismissed as an illusion. Firstly, efforts were aimed at keeping human beings at a distance from the supersensible, as apparent in the Eighth Ecumenical Council in 869. And then, because the supersensible realm had been kept at arm's length, as the Church saw fit, this realm came to be rejected altogether. A belief developed that human beings themselves had invented it, and that it had no reality. If we really wish to understand the origins of modern materialism, we have to seek them in the Church itself. Naturally, the Church is only the outward expression of deeper powers at work in human evolution, but we acquire insight into this evolution if we examine more carefully how one thing really emerges from another. In the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, right-thinking people believed that human powers of cognition were fit only for comprehending sensory things, while the non-sensory had to be left to revelation, unsullied by human thinking. Holding one's own individual views of the divine was deemed heretical, and would, they thought, lead only to error and illusion. The modern Marxist or social democrat, the true offspring of this view, has actually emerged from the Catholicism of former centuries, and holds that all science worthy of the name can only relate to processes in the physical world of the senses. No such thing as spiritual science can exist, since the spirit is an illusion. The only acknowledged cultural domain that bears any relation to it is social science, the science of social coexistence. This kind of outlook has, of course, assumed diverse forms in different cultural regions of the earth, but this is the general trend of it. From the 9th century onward, therefore, in Central and Western Europe, efforts were focused on cultivating belief in the supersensible without people knowing anything of it except through revelation, a kind of unknowing faith. The soul qualities of Central European peoples had to be taken into account, could not simply be ignored. It would not have worked to tell people to focus only on food and drink and other pragmatic matters, and ignore things too lofty for them. In Western Europe, this would not have worked. This was done, however, in Eastern Europe, and is the cause of the ecclesiastical division between Eastern and Western Europe. In Eastern Europe, people really were confined to a narrow focus on the sensory world. Their powers were to be preoccupied with physical matters and develop in this realm. And what unfolded as the Orthodox Church belonged to the lofty heights of the mysteries, quite untinged by sensory things. Here there was a strict division between what people elaborated out of their human nature and the real world of spirit, which, in a rarefied atmosphere, floated far above people in the rites of worship. What was the inevitable outcome of this? It was inevitable that, in various nuances of feeling, a view formed that only the sensory and physical realm has meaning. One can put it like this: powers of which no use is made, but which instead are locked away inside a person, do not develop, they wither. For centuries, people were prevented from encompassing the supersensible in their mind or spirit, and thus their powers became ever less practiced at doing so, and ultimately vanished altogether. This utter absence is something we now rediscover in modern socialist views. It is not their socialism itself that is so dire, but the wholesome rejection of supersensible spirit, which leads people to confine their scope to the social structures of a mere human animal. The laming of the human being's supersensible powers led eventually to a focus on mere social structures for human animals. This arose because people were forced to cease connecting their soul with a living experience of the stream of life that brings the blessing of knowledge of the mystery of Golgotha's meaning. And what was this connected with? In this fourth post-Atlantean epoch, luciferic powers were working very strongly to detach the human being from the cosmos. These powers always seek to isolate the human being egotistically, to cut him off from the whole spiritual cosmos, even in his knowledge of the physical cosmos. For this reason, no science existed at the time when this sundering reached its peak. This is luciferic. And so we must say that the division between sense-based knowledge and supersensible dogmatism is luciferic in nature. The Ahrimanic opposes the luciferic here, two adversaries of the human soul. This withering of supersensible human powers, leading to a purely brutish form of socialism, which is now set to have a devastating, destructive impact on humanity, must be ascribed to luciferic powers. The new element that is developing in our age is different in nature, is more Ahrimanic. The luciferic seeks to isolate people, cut them off from the supersensible spiritual realm, give them the illusion that they are a totality in themselves. By contrast, the Ahrimanic makes people afraid of the spirit, stops them approaching it, gives them the illusion that the spirit is not something that humankind can attain to, whereas luciferic influence works through culture and education to keep human beings away from the supersensible. The Ahrimanic does so through invoking fear of the spirit, a kind of intrinsic bodily fear that has emerged particularly since the 15th century. While luciferic sundering from the spirit came to expression especially under the mantle of Orthodox Christianity in the East. Ahrimanic sundering through fear was bred largely in the element of Western culture, and quite particularly in American culture. Such truths may feel uncomfortable to many, but they are true nevertheless. And we will make no headway today by talking in general terms, however mystically or theosophically, about our connection with the divine. We have to acknowledge reality. That is the only way to advance. And we can only create order again amidst our chaos by recognizing the distinctive nature of diverse streams that flow alongside each other. Each of these streams has a local origin, determined by particular conditions. But then it spreads and merges in a turbulent muddle with all the others to form what we call culture nowadays. I would call Americanism, as a collective term not to be applied to individual Americans, everything that betrays fear of the spirit, the longing to live only with the physical plane, and at most also with what rises into this physical sensory plane as coarse spirit, spiritualistic emanations and such like, which is not true spirit. Americanism is characterized by fear of the spirit, but this Americanism does not live merely in America itself, where it comes to very pronounced expression in the will character of the social realm, but above all in all science. Since the 15th century, this science has increasingly developed what we might call a, quote, fear of the spirit, close quote. Science is regarded as objective only where it sheds all inwardly engendered living concepts. Observation of nature is meant to remain untinged by any idea or concept engendered in the human soul. Only dead and arid observation is accepted by science, not a living, spirit-imbued quality. To introduce an idea or concept into one's observations in the Hegelian fashion, which is a truly Central European approach, or also in the way that Schelling or Goethe did, is regarded as a very suspect methodology. You see, people do not trust that they will grasp objective reality through their spiritual comprehension and experience. They think that they will open the doors to the arbitrary, to all that is not objective, by introducing the slightest subjective tinge into their observations and experience. But this is Ahrimanic. Science is a kind of universal Americanism, insofar as it abides by the principle of discarding anything subjective from the observation of phenomena, and this developed from a former Luciferic spirit isolation in the fourth post-Atlantean epoch. And so, we have added a new element to that old legacy, something which alongside what must develop productively and consciously in future, increasingly reveals its destructive powers. This new element is largely Ahrimanic in nature, is fear of the spirit, and has a destructive effect, a dissolving effect on all human culture, which must, after all, be rooted in the spirit. At the turning point, from the fourth to the fifth post-Atlantean epoch, and especially during the fifth epoch, the impulses I have now described increasingly emerged. When America was discovered and European culture was transplanted there, this fear of the life of spirit developed. But a tension arose in human souls at the same time, for by their very nature, the powers at work in European souls had a sense or intimation of their connection with the spirit in the cosmos. At the transition from the fourth to the fifth post-Atlantean epoch, this tension emerged during the centuries when modern history was developing. It was a tension due to a suppression of spirit in the human breast. You can say that this tension had to be stifled, partly through a clear understanding of the old legacy still present, and partly through a very realistic appraisal of the newly emerging Ahrimanic element. Here there arose the spiritual stream whose influence is actually much greater than most people believe. I spoke about this from a different angle last time. This spiritual stream, Jesuitism, sought to perpetuate the human soul's isolation from the realm of spirit. The inner principle of Jesuitism involves directing human evolution along a path that can keep people at a remove from their connection with the supersensible, from their real connection with it. It is self-evident that this distancing or detachment can be achieved all the better if the supersensible realm is presented in strict, dogmatic terms as something that human cognition cannot reach. But on the other hand, the Jesuit approach forges strong connections with modern science and Americanism. The greatness of Jesuitism lies in its deep engagement with the physical sciences. The Jesuits excel in the realm of the physical sensory sciences, since they count on our primary fear of the spirit, a human attribute that must be counteracted by guiding our nature toward the world of spirit. They count on being able to make a social construct of this fear by telling people that they cannot and ought not to approach the spirit, and that they, the Jesuits, will mediate it to everyone else. These two streams, of Americanism and Jesuitism, are in reciprocal interplay. But please do not take this too superficially. In all such things, we have to try to discover the deeper impulses at work in humanity's evolution. If you look for the forces that have created our present catastrophe, you will discover a curious collaboration between Americanism, as I have defined it here, and Jesuitism. In surveying these things, we find an old legacy working on in culture, on the one hand, and on the other, a new element. The Luciferic legacy and this new Ahrimanic element both stand in opposition to the true life of spirit as the redeeming element that humankind will need for its evolution. If we study a figure such as Bernard of Clairvaux with the right inner sympathy, we see that he tries to balance the physical sensory focus of human cognition by opening his soul to pious fervor and elemental experience to the spiritual and the divine. The quality of enthusiasm enters his being. This one-sided inclination for the spirit in human souls has a correlate in our own time with an inclination toward the dark side of things. In the 12th century we had Bernard of Clairvaux, while our own century has figures like Lenin and Trotsky. Whereas we see an impulse toward the supersensible in the first instance, in these modern figures we find a hatred for the supersensible, albeit expressed in other words and content. That is the dark reverse of those earlier times. On the one hand, the human soul pours itself into the divine, and on the other, human nature pours itself into the animalistic and brutish, with the aim of sustaining nothing but social structure. But we can only understand this if we are absolutely clear about one thing, which is, however, very alien to modern comprehension. Our modern world sets great store by theories, believing in the content of programmatic ideas. I have often discussed this. Theoretical content is never the decisive thing, for what matters is the reality that takes effect, the efficacy of an idea. Before the World War, at the turn of the century, a modern Marxist would naturally have quoted the teachings of Marx, Engels, and LaSalle as highly desirable doctrines for securing the well-being of humanity. People set great store by the content of programs and schemas, but such things are never what count in reality. Ideas never unfold in accordance with their content, but through powers present in them, quite distinct from their content. We only understand reality if we realize that ideas often have very little to do with reality, but that their content has a separate existence alongside it. You can devise a beautiful plan, very well thought out, and can be inordinately pleased with it and enthusiastic about it, as we have seen in the case of Marxists. But none of this counts. For an era as unspiritual as ours, this is just playing with fire. People think they are working to realize their ideas. Yet anyone who knows how life develops will also know that quite different effects will come about from the intended ones. Ideas, we can say, give rise to monstrosities in cultural life if they are not received with spiritual understanding. But the ideas of Marxism cannot be received spiritually, since they seek to eradicate the spirit. They will inevitably become monstrous, however lovely they appear. We should leave ideas to one side. Instead of thinking day has come on the earth by some power inherent in the earth itself, we should realize that day dawns because the sun rises. Let me read that again. Instead of thinking day has come on the earth by some power inherent in the earth itself, we should realize that day dawns because the sun rises. You can only explain the dawning day by looking beyond the immediate environment of the earth. And in the same way, you can only understand current events by looking back to the distant past. You fail to understand Bolshevism if you overlook the fact that it is a consequence or after effect of the Eighth Ecumenical Council in the year 869. You have to see Bolshevism as a result of the withering of spiritual powers that perceive the supersensible world. This is the inner connection needed for properly understanding what happens in the outer world and for taking the right stance toward it. Those who can trace the threads of history find it appalling to see movements which think arrogantly that they can reform the world, but which only count on the content of ideas without due regard to real effects. The content of an idea alone, however, fine or ugly, has nothing to do with it. Look at it like this. A child is born, a beautiful child. Its mother may be delighted. Mothers can, of course, be delighted, even if the child is not so beautiful. The child grows up and becomes a good-for-nothing, perhaps a criminal. This does not mean, does it, that the child was not beautiful to start with? We are still entitled to perceive the child's beauty. It seems to us that there is a contradiction between such beauty and later events that were not envisaged. In the same way, ideas live amongst certain groups of people who admire them and wish to use them to reform the world. But these ideas turn into monsters. You see, in themselves ideas are something dead and must first be enlivened by flowing into a living cultural context. If you read modern socialist tracts and overlook certain differences between them, you will find that despite dealing with different aspects of life and formulated in different ways, they actually very closely resemble tracts produced by Catholicism. Recently, for instance, I read you some passages from a pamphlet. If you compare the thought forms in this pamphlet, the mode of thinking, with rampant socialist ideas tending toward Bolshevism, this whole anti-cultural trend, then you will find the same ideas, basically as in a text by Lenin or Kautsky. The one is a development of the other. Reading certain dogmatic socialist tracts, you quickly feel you are very much in a Catholic world, in quotes. The only real difference is that something forbidden in Catholicism, philosophizing about certain subjects, becomes a passion, a principle in Bolshevism. All knowledge and mental progress must be explained in terms of the class war. This principle arises from the principle of Catholicism. In its current form, Bolshevism may only have a short existence, but humanity will long be plagued by what underlies it. We have to look clearly at all these things to realize how necessary it is for us to cultivate the right kind of spiritual life. pie-in-the-sky thinking is of no use. What we need is to use spiritual perception to see reality clearly and discover the connecting threads. Only if we grasp the full context can we intervene properly in world events, rather than living from old legacies or becoming fearful as new elements enter culture, which can only lead us into deep chaos. Only lead us deep into chaos. In the brutish forms of socialism, we have to see an elaboration of what developed in the fourth post-Atlantean epoch. This contains something luciferic, the luciferic fall. What is happening now is like the punishment for this original sin. The powers that were not applied to supersensible perception have now really become incapable of it. And this is accompanied by hatred of and repugnance for the supersensible. This is indeed a kind of punishment for the fact that we turned away from the supersensible, and this can explain much that is currently happening in the world. Impulses at work in human evolution come to expression in diverse ways, with different aspects and nuances. We can only understand what is happening in the world today by understanding these nuances. As Christianity spread, it took root in the people of Italy and Spain, and likewise in the population of what is now France and the British Isles. We know that the sentient soul was retained in Spain and Italy, while the rational or mind soul developed in French regions, the consciousness soul in the British Isles, and the I here in Central Europe. In Eastern Europe, similarly, a culture of the spirit self will arise, though at present this exists only in hidden germinal form and will unfold in the future. If only people would consider Western Europe in the light which spiritual science can shed on it. For instance, Italian traits, not the characteristics of individual Italians, who of course can grow beyond mere regional stereotypes, develop differently from those of the French or British. In Britain, national characteristics are connected with the consciousness soul. I have described these things in the past. Through this mode of life in the consciousness soul, a person is driven out into the plane of physical reality, though this is less marked in the British Isles than in America. As a result of this, having been cut off from the supersensible by ecclesiastical developments, the human being is now led toward the cosmic realm again, but as far as the consciousness soul is concerned, only toward external aspects of the cosmos. This means that the British only connect with the cosmos through economic principles. British thinking is largely informed by economics, by economic categories. If you grasp the inner connection between the consciousness soul and the physical world, you will see the inevitability of this. And likewise, you will see how inevitable it is that the stereotype French character, not necessarily that of a French individual, develops political thinking in its close relationship with a rational or mind soul. Similarly, national characteristics in Italy and Spain develop a close connection with animality because of the direct involvement here of the sentient soul. I am only briefly outlining these things, but they do convey qualities that live in national characteristics. If we consider German characteristics, which are currently involved in such tragic developments, we find that they draw upon the I capital. Light is shed on all of German history, if we consider this fact, which becomes apparent through perception of the world of spirit. This human I, undergoing the least degree of outward development, remains our most spiritual aspect. And this is why German people, through the I, have the strongest spiritual connection with the world of spirit. They cannot forge an economic, political, or animal connection with the cosmos. Instead, they connect with it only as it manifests in cultural life through the soul of particular individuals. For the eye always lives in individualities, and then flows out into the wider nation. German developments are apparent, most characteristically, in the substance of Goetheanism, and in the conceptions of Herder or Lessing, which lie one level higher than the physical sensory plane of existence. For this reason, one finds here a certain quality of alienation or distance from the physical realm, a feeling that these ideas and conceptions cannot fully belong to the physical sensory realm. And this, in turn, is why in recent decades, so much Americanism, on the one hand, and on the other so much that I do not wish to describe in further detail here, has streamed through Germany and alienated it from its inherent national characteristics. Eastern Europe will forge a connection with the spirit in a still higher way, developing a still more spiritual culture in opposition to what is now emerging for reasons I have described. But this is something for the future and is not yet present, is still confined within brutish tendencies from which it will seek to emerge. The countries of Western Europe are still connected with the fourth post-Atlantean epoch as though by rightful inheritance and tradition. A newer element, although opposed to Americanism, lies in German nature, a certain relationship with the world of spirit, sought within the realm of spirit itself. A German, in following the inner dictates of his own inherent nature, does not fear the spirit, but has a devoted inclination for it, as we find, for example, in typical, albeit higher form, in Goetheanism. In saying such things, of course, one has to express them rather radically, not out of chauvinism, but through perception of realities. I definitely do not say this to curry favor with anyone. As you saw last time, I am capable of saying things, if necessary, that might equally cause offense. But this must be said. It has largely been forgotten in Central Europe that German nature manifests a connection between the human spirit and the supersensible world, and that this connection, which needs to be further developed, stands in complete opposition to everything else coming to expression on earth today. If only we could recognize this, the past few decades would not, sadly, have brought us Americanism in this realm, and Bolshevism, and science and scholarship would have developed in a different way in Central Europe. From my past reflections, you know that Goetheanism could have given rise to a spiritual deepening of science and knowledge, but that Goetheanism remained in the margins, becoming only a one-sided pursuit also. Was it understood? Not so far. Yet it is the essence of German nature, and, as you can see from what I have said today, alien to other forms of scholarship and other national traits, which draw to a very large extent on old legacies and the new elements I described, as it were, emerging from their shells. We can see in various ways how Goetheanism has remained at one remove from materialistic science. Of course, people praise Goethe, yet at the same time, as I said, they appoint a former finance minister as president of the Goethe Society. The intrinsic element in German nature is something one has to feel as a continual reproach in other domains. People tend to defend themselves against something their own nature prevents them from acknowledging by scorning it. We must face this head on. People cast scorn on anything they feel to be a reproach to them, taking refuge in this subjective defensiveness. This is an important psychological reality. Such scorn will become ever more widespread, and it will be rooted in a sense of discomfort at the distinctive relationship of the I to the spirit. We must not flinch from seeing this clearly. If we ourselves did not have so much Philistinism and Americanism in us, we would recognize the two opposite poles at work here, German Goetheanism and Americanism. And we would know that we can only adopt the right stance to currents flowing through the modern world if we can observe them with an entirely open mind. We ought to shed all chauvinism and see things objectively. If we did so, however, we would no longer laud Americanism to the skies, as we have been wont to do. And since the characteristic trait of this Americanism is fear of the spirit, would come to see that the American element will increasingly act as a radically evil driving force in current catastrophic events. Those who see it differently are short-sighted, because they cannot survey the whole context. All that arises from the French political element, from the purely economic rigidity natural to the British, from the animal furor and sacred egotism of the Italian people, is as nothing to the larger scheme of things compared to the truly evil element emerging from Americanism. You see, there are three currents whose inner affinity and confluence produces a destructive effect upon human evolution. In diverse ways, each has assimilated old legacies and a new element, as I tried to outline briefly today. The destructiveness lies in these three currents. Firstly, in everything we can call Americanism, which increasingly tends to invoke fear of the spirit and make the world into a place where only physical life can unfold. This is actually quite different from the British tendency to try to make the world into a trading company. Americanism seeks to make it into a physical habitation, furnished as comfortably as possible, where one can live in comfort and prosperity. That is the political element of Americanism. If you cannot see this, you do not discern realities, are half asleep. The influence of this current will lead to the death of the human being's connection with the world of spirit. There lies in these American forces something that leads the earth to its end, a destructive element that ultimately spells annihilation for the earth, since it blocks off the spirit. The second destructive current is not just Catholicism, but all Jesuitism, which has a close affinity with Americanism. Whereas Americanism seeks to cultivate a fear of the spirit, Jesuitism tries to awaken a belief that we should not ourselves reach toward the spirit, which is beyond us, but allow spiritual wellsprings to be administered instead by those whom the Catholic Church appoints as its ministers. This current, too, wants the human powers which seek the spirit to wither. And the third current, emerging today in the East in such terrible symptoms, has its source in a socialism that addresses nothing but the human animal. Without seeing this dogmatically, Bolshevism has to be recognized as something it will be hard for humanity to overcome. These are the three destructive elements at work in modern humanity. To recognize them so as to oppose them in the right way, wherever they surface in current events, is something only possible when we stand on spiritual, scientific foundations. And next week I will speak further of this. The end of Lecture 20.